Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
Now, you're welcome back. Former rugby player Fergus Farrell, he suffered a life-changing accident. It was 7 years ago now, 2018. The fallout was pretty terrible for him and his family. And his account of it is very direct, very self-effacing. He doesn't hold back on his own mistakes. And there are some difficult subjects ahead, so use your discretion as always. Rebuilding a Man is the name of the book. He is still standing. Fergus Farrell, welcome.
Good morning, Oliver. How are you?
And you've a hell of a strong grip, I can attest now. Yeah,
my father always said a good handshake tells a good story.
Is that right? You're an Athenry man?
Yeah, born and bred and still there.
East Galway.
Love the place. Yeah.
How did you manage to go into rugby and not hurling in that part of the world?
Yeah, all my friends were actually big hurlers, and a lot of them were actually part of that very successful All-Ireland winning team, so would you believe? But yeah, I didn't have the skill sets for hurling.
Oh,
and there's a little rugby club called Munavee, about 6 or 7 miles away from me.
Yeah.
I mean, tiny rugby club. And I'll always remember how I got there. I used to have to sell fruit and veg. Well, not sell. I used to put up the stall for my dad in Athenry on a Saturday morning. And next to me, some of my friends told me about this.
You put up a stall?
Yeah. My dad used to sell fruit and veg in the markets.
Yeah.
And he put up the stall in the mornings. And my friends were telling me about this sport that was out in Munavee, and they got a free bus out to it. And I was going, if I went to that now, I wouldn't have to put up the stall.
Okay.
So next one I was starting, but I was getting on this bus, and then the thing that sold to me altogether after the training, you used to get a bag of chips and a bottle of Coke.
Oh, that was you sold.
Sold. Yeah, and I never looked back.
And it turns out you were very good at rugby.
I was decent at it. Like, I was big. I was huge. And then, as I got older, I started getting a bit fitter and things like that. And yeah, I loved it. Like, I just loved the whole ethos of the game.
Tell us your club.
Munavee Rugby Football Club.
And did you play on as well?
So I went into Galwegians. I played with them for a period of time. Then I played, obviously, the Connacht underages and juniors.
Somebody told you you'd never play for Connacht, did they?
When you're with a small little club like Munavee RFC, the stepping stones are a little bit harder
for sure
to make, and you're never expected to, you're expected to play for the club, and if you do that, you're doing great. Yeah. But for me, that wasn't in my mindset, just to stay at that. Once I got a little taste of, I think we were brought into an under 16 training camp or something like that. We were brought up to Sligo, up to the Sligo Grammar. We did a weekend up there, and we had a very good underage team. And a few of us went up to that, and that was it. Again, I was sold. I was like, this is better.
You're going to pursue this dream.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
You played for Connacht.
I played with underages, under 21s, the juniors, all that, yeah. So
dream come true?
Yeah, it really was. I loved playing with Galwegians as well, because at that stage, when you were playing with Galwegians, you would have been playing with a lot of the, whatever international were in Connacht would have been in Galwegians, and all the Connacht senior players who would be in Galwegians or Buccaneers. So you're playing at a really high level, and it was really enjoyable. So it was.
So you had a lovely sporting career, then you get married, you have the family, you're running a business. 7 years ago, October 2018, what kind of fella is the Fergus Farrell of that era at this point?
Head down, work hard, try to provide, try to build a big business. And I always had in the back of my mind, 2008, 2009 happened. Mm. And I remember an awful lot of people had to immigrate because of the financial crisis. And I seen a lot of my friends having to go. And, it kind of broke up families and things like that in terms of parents and siblings and kids. And I always remember that around that I didn't have to do that because my dad was in business.
Right.
So at that stage, I got involved with, doing taxi and hacking with him because he moved away from the fruit and veg. And
you were workers.
I felt lucky that I didn't have to leave Athenry because I had that option of staying and working with him, mm-hmm. where a lot of other families didn't, for whatever reason. So I always had that in the back of mind when I was building the business, that the idea was that my kids would have an option of having a business to fall into if they wanted to.
So you really pushed yourself.
Yeah, I did, yeah.
And you had buses, did you? Coaches?
Buses, yeah, for my sins. I ended up having, at the end of it, I had around 35 coaches. 65-odd staff. It was all going. Then we had a little chauffeur business to complement the bus business in Dublin here. And then on top of that, I secured the franchisee for Mercedes-Benz Bus and Coach after sales for the west of Ireland. And that was like something I dreamed about doing. You know, that was kind of, how I say, the pinnacle on top of everything. And that was really going to be retirement. You know, I think, you know, things were going very well.
Very well.
Yeah.
It's 20, and a house under construction for your family, three small kids.
Yeah.
It's just a couple of days before Halloween, isn't it? And you just see one of those heavy cast iron benches. Is that what it is?
Yeah, it was a bench that one of the mechanics in the garage would have made up to work on. So it was a really heavy, it was 60-80 kg solid bench, but it was like rustic, you know, because it was outside and it was just the rust would come off it easily. And the day that happened, I was in clean clothes. And if I was in my dirty clothes, I would have been, when I'm around the yard, I would have picked up the bench and just walked with it myself.
You would have lifted it up properly.
Yeah, yeah.
You were holding it away from your body.
Holding it away from my body, because Sean was holding it the other side. And I remember I took a few steps, maybe 10 or 12, and I got an awful bolt up through the back. Like, it was definitely a pain I'd never felt before, and I dropped it. But like that, you know, I'm a big, strong man, don't want to show weakness. I'm the boss, you know, it's typical masculine stuff. And I went down and I took 5-6 really deep breaths and, you know, let myself recover. And I said to Sean, well, the bench was in the way, now it had to be moved, it was in the middle of the yard. So I asked Sean to take it again, and one step and bang, I was down on the ground rolling.
Unimaginable pain.
Yeah, it was like, genuinely, the only way I could describe it is if somebody put a shotgun to the middle of my back and pulled the trigger, massive explosion in the middle of my back. I fell down, absolutely roaring in pain. And it took me like a couple of minutes to realise that after, you know, trying to get a handle of the pain, that I couldn't move my legs. The bench was on top of me. I tried to touch my legs and couldn't feel myself touching them. Couldn't move because I'd lost my centre of gravity. Everything was just gone. And then I remember I had a belt on me and felt like the belt was melting into my skin.
Wow.
Like, I couldn't figure this out. And so my focus then was, through it all, was trying to get this belt off to relieve that pain. Mm. But when I got that belt off, this surge of pain just came down through my legs and it was like plastic. It was melting into all my lower skin. Like, poor old Sean was looking down on top of me going, what's going on here? Because there wasn't a scratch on the outside of me.
And you're just moving a bench. It seems like the simplest thing in the world.
Yeah, just...
This was your life changing.
Yeah.
You go off to hospital, obviously, but you're still shouting things about the business. This is the maddest element of...
Yeah. So I was meant to be driving a bus. It was my Mullivale Rugby Football Club. They're about to play an All-Ireland quarter-final up in Belfast.
Really?
So I was really looking forward to the journey because, you know, I'd bring them up the Friday. They were going to be playing on Saturday. But I'd have a few drinks with maybe the management, who I know very well, the night before. The next day I get to watch a lovely game of rugby and drive them home. Like, what wasn't there to love about it? For me, rugby, sport, driving. But when that happened, I was there on the floor, and, you know, between it all, I knew I was meant to be getting on a bus. So I think it was Ian Raftery who was floating about the air because he was to do another job, like, you know, half an hour down the line or something like that. And I said, Ian, can you hop in that bus and go? So I was here trying to...
Organising a bus?
Yeah, so I was here trying to arrange everything. And Vincent, who's in the office, who had the bus licence, Vincent, can you go and do Ian's job? And this was all going through my head while I
couldn't feel your legs.
While I was running, still in running pain. Like.
What did they tell you in hospital?
So ultimately, I don't ever remember being told when I was in the A&E what had actually happened to me. All I remember was when I went through the MRI that I was in serious trouble. I had 12 hours to operate in it, but they couldn't do it here. They had to send me to Dublin.
Right.
I don't ever remember being told what was the problem.
That was an excruciating journey to the matter.
Oh, man. Yeah. So I just remember driving all the way to... I had to be... So first of all, they got an air ambulance down for me. But for whatever reason, between the jigs and the reels... Their ambulance couldn't land at night, I think.
It's late October or something.
Yeah. So I had to be blue lit by ambulance. And for that 2.5 hours, as a former bus driver, I knew exactly how long it was going to take. I knew as I was passing by the signs, how more. But that journey was like I had my hand in an electric fence for the whole journey. Shock after shock after shock.
Wow.
Just from the vibrating of the gearbox. And like, I had a compression suit around me as well, trying to keep me as still as possible. But yeah, it's a journey I'll never ever want to live. But when I got there, then all I wanted to do was get that operation, sign off that waiver form, and get it done. Because like, at this stage, I was here going, I can only get better from here.
When you wake up from the surgery, you're told what?
So when I woke up, again, I don't know how long it was. I was coming in out of consciousness. He sat down beside me and he was mumbling away stuff to me. I wasn't hearing it at all. I was focusing on these 2 feet that were in front of me that didn't feel they belonged to me. And all I remember, he stood up, and when he was standing up, he caught my attention. And when he did that, he said, "Have you any questions for me, Fergus?" And I remember him saying to him, I looked up and I looked at my 2 feet, and I looked back up and I said, "Is this the way I'm going to be?" And he sat down and he put his hand on my shoulder and just said, "Sorry, Fergus, but you've been very, very, very unlucky." And literally got up and walked out.
That was the most crushing
moment
you could have experienced.
Yeah, because it's like,
you'll never walk again, essentially.
He never, like, at the end of this stage, that wasn't said to me. If it had been said to me, I don't remember it. But I just remember being gone. Yeah, I had this realisation that I'm in serious trouble here.
If the toe or the foot or something doesn't move in 72 hours, you're in big, big trouble.
Yeah.
So you start this process of visualisation.
Yeah. So I was lying on my back. I had a very, when he got up and walked out, I had a really bad moment. I had a few really bad thoughts, you know. But I also knew that he came in the following day and told me the stats, and I said, okay, this is my time to start working for myself. So first thing I knew, I had tools in my box. Number one is I knew how to work hard. But I knew that if I just laid there and had nothing to do, that would drive me absolutely crazy. Because, you know, being focused on the pain, focused on all the negatives. So I did that. But I also then started using visualization. Because I'd used it all my life. I think I used it way before it was a thing. You know, I remember when I wanted to put on that green jersey for the Irish under 18s and stuff like that.
You were picturing you in the jersey.
Exactly, yeah. Running around the fields. And when I wanted to own my first new bus in the business, same. And I would use it in many other smaller things as well.
What was your image this time?
So I wanted to move my big right toe, but I remember I was lying there in this bed in immense pain. And there was a fuse box. What I thought was a fuse box, and I was up in the corner of the room, and I thought that that'd be my brain. And then on the right hand side, I had a switch, a light switch, and that was going to be my big right toe. If I couldn't move my big right toe, that light switch would turn. I could turn on that light switch and turn on the bulb overhead.
Right.
And if I turned on that bulb, that was me making the reconnection of my broken spinal cord. So it was like my brain was the fuse board. Then I'd have the wire going from the fuse board to that switch. So I'd visualise that switch going down through my body. You could see the actual spark. I could see the spark going through my body, down through my broken spinal cord, groin, calf, into the big toe. And then if I moved my big toe, that would turn on the switch and that would complete the circuit. And I did this hundreds and hundreds of times and dreamed people coming and going and visiting me, and it was mostly at night, because that's when you're there at night and you're completely alone.
Hours, and days of it.
Well, it's 72 hours. I did it and did it and did it and did it. And unfortunately, zero. Absolutely nothing. At that stage, then I was told, that's it. Unfortunately, you're going to be wheelchair bound for life. And obviously, you know, did I accept it? I really don't know. I was so, you know, probably drugged up. You know, still on morphine, whatever else. But all I know is I couldn't lie in that bed and not have something to do.
Right.
It's just not in my DNA.
So you continued on.
I continued on that fight. I just didn't give up on myself. I said, right, okay, this is my body, my life. I'm going to work my ass off for it. Even though physically I couldn't move or anything like that, but mentally and emotionally, I put every little ounce into it. And thankfully, it worked.
It was 2:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
21 days since the bench.
I'll never forget it. 21 days and 2:30 a night is the worst time to do anything in a hospital. There's just literally nobody around. And I knew, I was there, I think I must have been watching Netflix or something, just, you know, and I said, right, okay, couldn't sleep. There was no sleep going on, by the way, for a long time. And I started visualising again, and I thought I saw this toe move. Like, I mean, it was only a little flicker. Like, you could, like, barely a flicker. I was going, I think that's after moving. But I knew nobody was going to come into me for 4 hours.
Did you think you were imagining it?
I thought I was going crazy.
Yeah, okay.
You know, I was actually genuine, because it wouldn't happen all the time. And next thing I think I'd see it moving again. And maybe an hour later, it'd move again. You know, so even though I was trying to move it all the time, it would only move a bit. And then Gary came in, and the nurse's aide, who, like, full disclosure, he used to have to come in and put a depository up my bum so I could go to the toilet a couple of hours later.
Yeah.
But when he came in that morning, I was like, Gary, I think I'm after moving my big right toe.
This would be your first human witness.
Yeah. And he just said, yeah, show me. And, like, again, I had to go through this whole process. It wasn't like it just happened.
Yeah.
So I had to go and visualise it all again and try to move that spark all the way down through my body. And eventually moved. He said, that's after moving.
He was amazed.
Yeah. Well, he was happy, you know. And then he went off and got the nurse, and same thing happened. And yeah, and then Dr. Cullen came in. Then
this is the start of the process, which is,
yeah.
I mean, I've seen you walk in here today.
Yeah.
Because incredibly, you get through, you get the movement back.
Yeah.
It's not completely healed, obviously. You're moved to the National Rehab Hospital Centre. That's in Sallynagan here in Dublin. And make a lot of progress, don't you?
Yeah, look, it's an incredible place. I think I could write 10 books about the place, you know, how incredible it is. But when I arrived there first, I was horrified. It was like, you know, I wasn't expecting what, you know, I thought I was in a bad place, but unfortunately there was other patients there who were like in a lot more severe place than me. But then it made me realise how lucky I was to what I had. I was able to use my eyes, my legs, or sorry, not my legs, but my hands. I was able to eat, drink, and I was able to do all those things. So it made me very quickly realise to be very, very happy with what I had,
yeah,
and not be envious of what I didn't have.
But you had your goals, didn't you?
Yeah, I had my goals, and ultimately, when I went to the NRH, I didn't know where I was going to end up. You know, I was still told I was going to be, you know, paralysed, wheelchair. So all I did was, every day was a day to improve.
Mm-hmm.
So I got up, worked hard. I used what I had, and I never relented. Every day, just get up and go. Now, I was lucky, I had physical gains, so because of that, I was able to latch onto it, and that kept me going and going and going. And
your goal was essentially to walk out of there.
Yeah.
And you do this in March.
Yeah, I don't know actually the right date. I should know that date, but I don't. It was actually April, I think it was.
Was it?
I think so, yeah. And I think it was. I should know that.
It was a difficult walk, but you managed to do it.
Yeah, I got out on my own 2 feet. Now, when I did it, it was more of a symbolic thing, because ultimately, the physios were either side of me as I walked out, and I stumbled out the doors. But I got down, I hopped into my own car, which I'd learned to drive in the NRH with hand controls.
Yeah, adapted,
I drove home, right, all the way back to Athenry.
Now, this kind of should be the movie moment, shouldn't it, with you? You're the miracle man.
Yeah.
But as you're quite brutal in the book, in your personal life, you make what you describe as one of the stupidest mistakes.
Yeah, life. Yeah. And it's a decision that I have to live to this day, unfortunately, you know. And, you know, it's something that I will always regret, but I can't do anything about it.
Tell us what you did.
Unfortunately, I talked to girls online. Yeah.
You had the phone.
I had the phone, and
in hospital.
Yeah, I was lying in bed. Yeah.
You didn't come clean to your wife. She found the messages.
Yeah, she did, yeah.
And this was after everything. She's got the 3 kids at home. She's worrying about you nonstop.
Yeah.
How do you feel about it now?
I still, to this day, I feel terrible about it. But I can't do anything about it, unfortunately. I did do it. And that's just, you know, I would like to be able to do something about it, but, you know, I can't rewrite the history.
Can you blame the accident for it?
Look, there's elements that, yeah, of course, I do believe that it was something that was done because of what I was going through. But can I blame it? I have to take some responsibility myself as a person, as a human being, as a man. But there was elements of why I did it, because why in that moment?
Yeah,
I don't know that myself. You know, I really don't.
Sadly, it's the consequences. Your marriage ends, but you're in friendly terms with.
Yeah, look,
looking after the kids together.
Yeah, my wife is an incredible person. She has done an amazing job with the kids. She went through a very hard period at that time with 3 young kids, just after moving into a new house and a husband who did what I did do and who was paralysed. So I can only imagine she was going through a very, very difficult time at that time herself. And yet she was able to do what she did.
Yeah.
You know, so I have nothing but admiration for her. And unfortunately, we are where we are now.
That's going on. You're back at home recovering. This is just months really after. You obviously go to a dark place in your life. The business is not going well because obviously you're not there.
Yeah.
A contract goes. Tell us about the day in Galway that you describe in the book, your darkest moment.
Yeah, just that day. So it was just, I was coming back from, there's obviously a lead up to it, but on that day I was riding back into the house after being down in Limerick with a friend of mine, I drove back, and when we drove back, I was coming into the house, and herself with the three kids were coming out, and I remember putting the window down, and obviously it was a very bad place already, and she just said she was going with the kids, and I was going, okay, where? And she says, we're going. At that stage, I said, I'm done fighting. I'm done.
You couldn't blame her, obviously.
No, 100%. Yeah, no. But if she said black, I would have said white at the time. You know, I was so toxic, so negative, and the business was failing, and everything was just failing in my life. Everything.
You go into the city.
Yeah, I go into the city, and ultimately I go to a bridge called O'Brien's Bridge. It's well known for, you know, suicides and stuff like that, because there's a fast running river there. It's Tyle River. But when I arrived in there, the tide was out, but it was coming back in. I can't really swim, so I turned around and I went to a bar that I never went to before, and I had two pints of Guinness.
To wait for the tide?
Tide to come in for 2 hours. And obviously at this page, I didn't know this, but my parents had put an alert out for me. My cousin as well had put an alert out for me, but to the guard, say, Fergus is out there, look out for him, whatever else. But I left the bar 2 hours later, and I always remember, I didn't take my focus off where the footpath met the building. I kept my focus in there so I'd make no eye contact with anybody. And I was less than 200 metres away from that bridge. And next minute, a car pulled up, a guy runs across the road and kind of confronts me and goes, Gussie, that's my nickname, what are you at? And I just crumbled. Ger Brady, a guy I used to play rugby with from Ballina, saved my life that day. 200 metres away, yeah.
He's a guard.
And when he heard in the BP my name, Fergus Farrell, earlier on, and he says he went back, is that Fergus Farrell from Athlone Rye? Because we hadn't seen each other in years. Mm. And he said yeah. And he spent all that time going around the beaches, all the well-known suicide places in Galway, and found me 200 metres away from that bridge. Yeah, it gives me the chills even to this day.
Yeah. Just waiting in the tide, and that was the time he got to you.
Yeah.
Thankfully, you recover from that.
Yeah.
But it requires time in a psychiatric ward.
Yeah.
You're looking for goals in your life, and these challenges become a huge thing.
Yeah, challenge. I discover challenges in competition make me, define me, keeps myself straight, keeps myself focused, keeps my mind occupied.
There's brilliant coverage in the book of the toughest trek, your attempt to go row from New York to Galway with Damien Brown, who manages just about to do it, but you had to be rescued halfway through, and it's well worth reading into that. Yeah. But I want to kind of, before we finish up, because you've told the story so brilliantly, how is life now?
Life is fantastic now. I've learned an awful lot of life lessons over the years, and you know, I try and use those life lessons best possible to live as good as a life. And my focus is on my three kids and making sure that they have a lovely life and they've got good moments with their dad and their mother. So life is fantastic. You know, I can't.
Can I ask how you make a living these days? Because the business is
gone. Yeah, it is. Yeah, unfortunately. So I do talk. I'm a public speaker, keynote speaker now, around obviously health and safety, mental health, mental strength, and just around my lived experiences and the knowledge I've gained through that. You know, and it's something I'm actually really, really passionate about.
And you talk about masculinity because you had to confront your own fears of being weak and vulnerable.
Yeah, I do. It's something that I think obviously men are struggling with in this day and age, because they don't know whether to be, you know, one or the other. And when you're in the middle, you don't know how to identify yourself properly. And Obviously, with me going up, standing in front of people, especially men, you know, I'm a big, strong man. You know, I'm a farmer's son, you know, ex rugby player, and they see me being vulnerable and showing my weaknesses, and hopefully they can say, well, look, that's a man who's gone through it, but is still here and is still a man.
Someone to look up to.
Yeah.
How's your health?
Health is fantastic now. I'm still in 24/7 nerve pain, still have a lot of issues. I have a lot of hidden disabilities, which I find mentally tough to deal with because people see me again and it's you see me walk in that door. Yeah. But everything's mechanical. Everything I do is a thought process. So it's exhausting. And you don't see that. So in terms of, I have had a period of time where I was completely disabled. But I find dealing with hidden disability the hardest.
Right.
Yeah, because people judge, or the lack of judgment, you know.
That's hard.
Yeah, it is, yeah, because, I do have some issues, you know, and I can't help it around my, so I have some bowel movements, things like that every now and again. And, you know, so I'm a grown man, and people look at me, I'm big and strong, and they say I have no issues, I'm getting on with life. But, you know, when you can only sleep 3 or 4 hours max a night, it does wear you down eventually, you know.
This is mostly why you're putting your story out as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Fergus Farrell, it's absolutely incredible journey. Marion says, what an amazing story. God bless him.
Yeah.
The book is called Rebuilding a Man. It's out now in shops, published by Gill. But Fergus Farrell, look after yourself. And I also want to tell you that Fergus Farrell is planning to become the first person with a spinal injury to walk across America, and he's raising money for Spinal Injuries Ireland. That's happening in August 2026. So look that up and donate. That's what he's trying to do. The book is called Rebuilding a Man. And also, given what we were talking about, I want to give you the support helplines online, all the support helplines on rte.ie/helplines, rte.ie/helplines. That's all our business for today. Claire Byrne is coming up next. We'll chat again tomorrow. Have a lovely Thursday, everybody. Slán.